Today, the first time homebuyer's nightmare. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Worth Notice, post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Tarek Brooker, journalist. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good. Friday afternoon, time for another catch-up. And as always, plenty of data to talk about.
Oh, is it there ever, mate? I don't think there's ever been a dull moment, has there? You know, since we started our chats in, what was it, late 2019, I don't think we've ever had a show where there wasn't too much to talk about.
No, exactly right. You know, we've never had a show where we've turned up and said, well, actually, we haven't got anything to talk about today, right? That would be a very boring show, I suppose, as well. So I suppose we should be grateful for all the confusion and the chaos and the multiple sources of data and the conflicting data, because at least it gives us something to moan about.
Yeah, well, that's something besides the cold, yes. But no, it's interesting looking at today's housing finance data, showing that, you know, as we discussed in our last show, that, you know, first home buyer finance commitments are coming off the boil and investors are increasingly taking their place in the market.
Yeah, it's pretty consistent now in the data. I mean, you know, we shared some data with you the other week in terms of what my surveys were showing, which is that there are less first-time buyers now actively considering buying, and that's partly because some of those supports were actually taken out of the system a little while ago. Plus, of course, the fact the prices have gone much higher, so it's more harder for people to afford to get in. And probably investors are starting to get a bit itchy fingers and want to come and buy in the market. And of course, they can outgun first-time buyers thanks to tax breaks, thanks to all of the interest-only loans that are now available from the banks and the looser lending standards. So, yeah, I think the era of first-time buyer booms is probably over for a bit.
Yeah, it certainly looks like it's coming off the boil and probably for the foreseeable future with prices rising the way they are. I mean, I did a little bit of an analysis, forward-looking, you know, years and years into the future, you know, doing estimates based on housing affordability for first home buyers. And even with, like, the most generous sort of wage growth forecasts of, you know, 3% past, you know, the current budget's estimates, which I used in the analysis, you look at the data and it's just, if you started saving as a first home buyer today with prices rising even at 5% in a place like Sydney, you will never, ever, ever be able to afford a home if prices keep rising at the current rate. Because it's like the old compound interest thing that financial advisors often use to explain super. It's like, okay, if you have $100,000, it's going to grow into X number by the time you're 50. But then between the time you're 50 and the time you're 60, due to the way compound interest works, it's going to grow more than it did in that time, even though the contributions are a lot lower. But that's just the way compound interest works. But the problem is now we're seeing it with housing prices, where a 5% increase on what's Domain's median average now, 1.3 million in Sydney, is an extra $65,000. And if you're a median earning household, you can't come up with 20% of $65,000 every year. It's just not happening.
No, the mathematical, mathematically, it's an impossibility unless you've got really wealthy parents who can pull equity out of their property and hand it down, as we've discussed on the Bank of Mum and Dad previously. But that's only a proportion of the market. And if you run the numbers ahead, you know, assuming that income stays relatively flat in real terms, and the Reserve Bank is still saying that, right, and you still see home prices accelerating away further, the gap between what's affordable and what you can buy is impossible. And this is the problem, right? Because I think people need to understand there's a reason why we're in the situation that we're in. These are policy settings that have been deliberately placed. This isn't just an accident. This isn't something that's just happened over years. And, you know, these are policy settings that have been wrong for a generation at least now. And unfortunately, first-time buyers or prospective first-time buyers are reaping the whirlwind.
They are. Michael West had a fantastic video about this today, talking about how basically how the market is effectively rigged in favor of people who are already in the market. I mean, if you just look at the math in terms of, you know, putting together a deposit, you know, the normal sort of, you know, median, well, it's average, should I say, more average 20% deposit, it's just a it's a mathematical impossibility for a lot of people. And it's, I talk to people, you know, even people in their early to mid 40s, and it's just a heartbreaking reality for these people. People who've been saving for a decade only to just have the market run away from them, even just in the start of this year. I mean, you know, Domain reckons that housing prices rose by 8% in the first quarter alone. And I mean, you can't come up with that sort of money like that. It just doesn't work. You know, you can't come up with, you know, an extra 8% on top of your deposit just in the space of 3 months. And it's a heartbreaking reality. And I don't really know why it's not being explored more, because it is just the definition of a Ponzi scheme. Housing prices can't rise at 5% per annum forever while incomes, you know, sort of relatively stagnate, especially considering how high they are in some of the capital cities. Like, maybe, don't get me wrong, in places like Perth or Brisbane, maybe they could rise for 5% for longer than we think. But in places like Sydney, you know, 5% rises are going to put it out of the reach of a lot of people. I mean, although I suppose the market is increasingly just the wealthy selling to the wealthy, or the homeowners selling to other homeowners.
Well, of course, that old idea of the property ladder, once you're on the ladder, the next rung up is a little easier than the first one off the ground. Although, actually, I think these days the rungs are further apart than they used to be, right? So it's much more difficult. But, you know, you mentioned Ponzi scheme. I was interested that Shane Wright in the SMH wrote a very good article yesterday, which I featured on my show last night, which basically said, look, everybody's just got this short-term view. It's all being driven by the low interest rates and the policy settings. But it is a Ponzi scheme. It is essentially pulling people in at the bottom to try and push the overall values higher. And if you're on the ladder, then sure, you might be doing okay. But there are a lot of people who can't get on the ladder. And the other point is, I if you start late, let's say you don't buy until mid-40s, right, rather than mid-20s, that means that you've still got a mortgage as you go into retirement. So that means that now you're going to be in debt for a lot longer, and potentially what will have to work for longer, later in life. And more people are still going to retirement, according to my surveys, with a mortgage still in tow. And that means that they're going to be paying effectively interest and mortgage repayments right into old age. Now, that structurally is another issue which we should also, you know, just reflect on. So this isn't just impacting first-time buyers per se, it's actually impacting many other segments of the market as well. And particularly, you're right, those with property, you know, trading up, trading down, probably doing okay. But a lot of people aren't. And I keep coming back to this weird situation. Other people don't see it. I mean, I see it. That, you know, a proportion of people are doing really well, but two-thirds of people aren't. And yet, there isn't enough focus on the ones who are actually struggling and are really, really now up against it from all sorts of directions. But again, the policymakers and the RBA aren't interested. And I don't know whether you saw the discussion in Senate estimates, but Guy Debelle was there explaining the wealth effect and basically saying, you know, the wealth effect is good. It means that more people will spend more. And Nick McKim said, well, hang on a moment, what about the inequality issue that's creating? And, you know, basically Debelle said, well, yeah, there is an inequality being, you know, created, increased, but, you know, we've got a bigger issue, which is getting unemployment down. I'm thinking that's a really, really lame excuse.
But the problem is that even the RBA's own research shows that in the long run, higher levels of household debt, which are going to end up resulting from this debt binge that we're currently seeing, it's just going to end up hampering economic growth in the long term. And as people of my generation and younger end up spending more and more of their income trying to save for a house deposit, it's just going to end up kneecapping the economy going forward anyway. So, I mean, you've got the Bank of International Settlements, you've got the RBA's own research, you've got a plethora of other central banks talking about how the wealth effect will have the high household debt, which drives the wealth effect, ends up negatively impacting the economy. And then they turn around and they go, and they scratch their head and they go, why hasn't real household disposable income per capita risen in 10 years up until the Morrison government started throwing money at households through the JobSeeker and JobKeeper programs? And it's just ridiculous. And, you know, just while you're on the thing of, you know, people retiring with mortgage debt, I'm pretty sure that one of the old ancient translations of mortgage is life debt. And that's pretty much what it is now for a lot of people.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely right. And, you know, we've discussed before the 50-year and 100-year mortgage, and the idea that actually as a mortgage holder, you will never repay that mortgage. You will be in hock until your dying breath, right? And of course, the financial system loves that because basically that gives them certain cash flows forever, right? And that's what they relish. So the financial system likes that model. Of course, the Reserve Bank is saying, well, you know, that means that people are going to have more disposable income. So that means, you know, basically there's going to be more momentum in the economy. I don't see how that works, by the way, because if you've got big debt, you don't have the money to spend elsewhere, as my surveys show in the mortgage stress surveys. But yeah, this is a fundamentally broken model. And of course, we are out on a limb if you compare any of the standard metrics for housing relative to most other countries around the world. We're top of the tree, or nearly top of the tree, pretty much however you look at it, adversely, right? And that's the problem. And of course, if interest rates do start to go up, and I did a show a couple of days ago with somebody from Mozo who basically was highlighting the fact that, you know, deposit rates are going up a little and mortgage rates are likely to go up too before the Reserve Bank moves, even a small move up on mortgage rates will have a damaging effect on those with these big mortgages and these lifetime commitments.
It's that, and it's also the impact it's going to have on the the psyche of market participants. You know, we've got to a point now where we haven't had a rate rise in, well, the best part of a decade. It may actually be over a decade. I need to check that. But, you know, basically 10 years without it really entering into the equation for property owners and prospective property buyers. But if you suddenly shift to a rate hike environment, as has happened in multiple places around the world, in places like Russia, Brazil, you know, in some of these emerging market nations who are feeling these inflationary pressures and rate hike pressures a bit earlier than we are, you just got to think about what would it be like if we were stuck then in a long-term cycle of rate hikes. Now, it doesn't need to be rate hike, you know, one after another, but it's just that having your finger on the pulse, just thinking, oh, when's the next one coming? How much is that going to eat into my household income? Oh, I better be a little bit more conservative when I buy a house.
Yeah, so the psychology of surviving in a rising rate environment is very different from what most people have experienced, as you say, for a decade or so. And I've lived through a few of those, and it's not pretty, because you have to assume that rates will go on rising at some point, right? And you try and adjust accordingly. And interesting that point about the disposable income. I saw a few articles today celebrating a rise in disposable income, right? You know, for the first time for forever, right? Well, you made the right point, which they didn't make. It's all thanks to the government handouts, right? But that's not going to continue. So it's artificial. You know, we are still in the same situation where true wage growth is close to zero. And the Reserve Bank is still saying it won't be 2024 before we see anything, you know, at all. So there is no get out of jail card in terms of the wages side of the equation, unlike in the early 2000s when we had a lot of debt. Wages were growing a lot faster. So, you know, we are into this long meander where effectively the debt burden continues to rise. The upward trajectory of interest rates looks as though it could be there. And all of that could be quite damaging in terms of people's confidence and their ability to spend, which, of course, is what the Reserve Bank wants in the first place. Because spending from consumers, 60% of activity, economically speaking, is, you know, what they're banking on. Well, it's a very narrow basis on which to plot an exit from a crisis, in my view.
Well, it's pretty much the whole world at this point that's doing that. It's all, I mean, in the words of Frank Sinatra, it's only a paper moon, you know? Everything's just make-believe at this point. You know, we're meant to look at these pieces of economic data and say, oh, wow, look, you know, the economy grew by 1.8% in Q1, and it's like, well, sure, of course it did. You know, I literally said that on Twitter, anything under 1% would be a really, really bad sign. And that was pretty much the consensus. And 1% was pretty much the consensus view. It's like, well, duh, of course the economy's growing. That's what happens when you throw hundreds of billions of dollars at it. Yeah. And I think it's really important to keep in mind that even this year, this upcoming financial year, the deficit as a percentage of GDP, so to be completely fair, to factor in inflation and everything else, the deficit as a percentage of GDP is larger than the largest deficit under Rudd by about 15 or 20%. And that's really saying something, considering the fact that the Liberals smashed Rudd and Labor over the head with it for well over a decade, saying your deficit. And now we're running a bigger deficit, but we're talking about how fantastic the economy is. And it's like, well, if the economy is so fantastic, can we turn the taps off and stop indebting future generations, or can we not do that?
No, we can't do that because there's an election to win.
Oh, but of course. That well, we all know that's coming relatively soon.
Yeah.
I don't think that ScoMo really wants to see what next year has to hold for the Australian economy, because who knows what's in store for next year with the global economy, because you know there's some already very concerning signs emerging in the US of things, you know, disappointing to the downside. I mean, as we discussed, you know, with my little slideshow in our last chat, you know, and not only that, but it keeps happening. We keep seeing these disappointing figures, and all of a sudden people are going, oh, well, maybe things aren't so great.
Well, there are certainly some signs in the US, and, you know, the latest wages and employment statistics, you know, is an interesting bit fragmentary in some cases. But, you know, you can make an argument that there are some good signs, but there's also some relatively bad signs. And the point is, a lot of the temporary stimulus that was thrown in was, you know, just handing out checks, right? But that's not the same as permanent, secure and employment. That's the problem that they're wrestling with at the moment. And, you know, there are some worrying signs there. And, of course, they've still got this virus bubbling around and the variants bubbling around and all of those things. Although, of course, they have a much higher proportion of their population vaccinated relative to Australia. Well, actually, relative to almost, almost all of Australia. We seem to be on the back foot on that as well.
Well, I think it's just the nature of the game at this point. You know, we've had such a good run with things, relatively speaking. I mean, obviously Victoria and Melbourne in particular is a bit of an exception. But, you know, compared with, say, like the UK, which has been in lockdown for, you know, I think even longer than Melbourne, to be honest, and at least in the urban centres, and, you know, around the world, I think it's easy for us Australians to turn on the nightly news and just be like, well, I don't really need to get vaccinated. I don't really need to worry about the virus that much because, you know, we're safe. Our borders are closed. You know, we only have a couple of thousand people coming in every week. It's not really that big of a deal, relatively speaking. And I think that, you know, it's just, it feeds, you know, good old Australian exceptionalism. Aren't we fantastic? Haven't we done a great job? Oh, we don't need this. We're different. So, you know.
I never hear that about Australians in Australia. Never hear it.
Well, I don't know. Perhaps that's because, you know, I spent quite a lot of time overseas growing up and, you know, in my travels even as an adult, and you come back and you go, we do think quite highly of ourselves here in Australia. And there's nothing wrong with that, you know, that we like to celebrate our positive achievements, you know, things like, you know, Medicare, you know, things like mateship and all those values that we hold dear. I mean, whether or not they actually sort of get put into place in modern society the way that we would like is another matter, though.
So I've got this theory that there is this idealistic view that we have about what Australia is and what it stands for, right? And some of it's true, you know, so the beaches and the sunshine and those sorts of things. But some of the other things are sort of mythologies, really, rather than realities for many people. And yet those are some of the things that are quite often, you know, celebrated to quite an extent. And I would argue that sometimes over-positioned as the reasons why Australia is just a great place to be. And look, I think Australia is a great place to be. I don't have a problem with people celebrating it. But just think how much better it could be if some of those policy settings were different. That's what I keep coming back to, and that's my big frustration, right? There are things that we could be doing differently because we had the opportunity to do it that will actually produce a much more well-balanced economy, a much, much fairer economy, and one that actually really could lay a foundation for a much more prosperous future, and yet we seem to be turning our back on it.
I think you make a really important point in the sense that we have these discussions not because we dislike Australia or because we hate Australia. It's because we love it. It's because it's important to us, you know, because it's our home, and you want your home to be at its best. And it, you know, that doesn't always mean just going to Bunnings and buying paint and renovating it and doing stuff. It's about doing the same thing, you know, metaphorically for our entire country, you know, to make the best possible Australia that we can. And I think one of the things I find the most frustrating is, you know, I've spent time, you know, interviewing people on welfare, interviewing homeless people, you know, and I've been doing this both as a personal you know, project sort of documenting it, and both as a journalist later on for well over a decade since the financial crisis. And it's just sad that these people have fallen through the cracks so badly in a country so wealthy that we can't afford to build social housing, to put roofs over the head of these people. And I'm not talking about, you know, the quintessential dole bludger who spent the last 20 years smoking dope and surfing at Byron Bay and living out of his van. You know, I'm talking about people who've worked with their hands, who, you know, people who've been, you know, business owners, and things have gone bad and something beyond their control has occurred. Or, you know, I've spoken to tradies in their mid to late 50s who just, you know, their body's just given up the ghost after 40 plus years of hard labor. And they end up on the scrap heap. And if they can't, and not only that, but these days, as you say, they're retiring with mortgage debt. They're sitting on bigger and bigger debts. And if they can't work, they're stuffed. And there's just, there needs to be a safety net for these people. And I'm not saying that we need to go out and do the whole UBI thing and give everyone a house and do all this stuff, but there does need to be a safety net. And the truth is we've had it before. You know, we had it in the 50s. We had, you know, people coming back from the war, getting houses, people who needed them, getting social housing, and it worked fantastically. You know, people then later on, when they got back on their feet or they got a better job, they ended up buying the property. And that created, you know, that improved home ownership rates here in Australia after the war. And I don't know. There are a lot of different things that we could do that I think most of us could agree on. But I think that there's too much inertia, shall we say, behind the status quo, both politically and economically. Because, I mean, at this point, you know, unless you smash the property bubble to pieces, we can't fix our country. It's just a sort of, I mean, I'm not going to say it's impossible, but it's just mathematically extremely difficult to do so.
Well, I think I've used the analogy before of the black hole sucking more and more of the economy into it, right? And we're sort of circulating around the edge of the black hole, getting closer and closer and closer as more and more and more of the economy sucks, you know, the housing related stuff into it, right? So more of the debt relates to housing, more of the activity relates to construction, all of those things. And we've just forgotten on what basis the economy should be developed. And we've basically got this narrow basis, which is effectively, you know, property related. Now, you know, there is a place for property investment, there's a place for property construction, but the prices are way, way, way too high. And then I see people saying, oh, you know, well, you know, they're going to continue to rise, you know, another 20% over the next two or three years, some are suggesting. And I'm thinking, well, it's all debt driven. It's all about that bigger debt pool. It's all more inequality. And more and more of us are going to be left behind. And that's not the sort of society that I really want to be part of, really.
No, and I think part of the problem here in Australia is that we have had it better before. You know, you look back to the, you know, the late 1990s, the mid to late 1990s, and home ownership was relatively affordable. I'm not going to say it was super affordable for some people, because obviously it varies depending on your income, etc. But it was a hell of a lot more affordable and a lot better than it is now. And I just think about quality of life for people. You know, I think about, you know, growing up in my little dead end street in Melbourne, you know, kicking around a soccer ball with the local kids or playing cricket with the bins, and having the space to do that. You know, having the room to be able to do that, or walk down the beach, or have access to transportation or things to keep kids entertained, rather than, you know, living in some dog box high rise that, you know, that probably, you know, has a reasonable chance of having flammable cladding, or living out in the sticks, you know, with no amenities in these estates where there is no space for the cricket game in the street, and it's far too busy, and there's nowhere near enough room, and there's no backyard for you to have the, you know, the local game of rugby with all the local kids like we used to when we were like I did when I was little. Mm. You know, there's no room for that. I mean, you know, you could have a game of rugby with about three people in some of these tiny little backyards. And I mean, I think it's funny that we talk about the great Australian dream. You know, the quarter of an acre block, you know, the dog, the cat, you know, veggies by the fence, you know, the Burke's Backyard theme song. But we're not, but I rarely see any developers producing the great Australian dream. Instead, we put four or five houses on the same block and just say, oh, well, stuff it. That'll do.
Well, I'll tell you something. The value of property is more about the value of the land than it is about what's on the land, right? And so just think about that. When you've subdivided one of those, I don't know, you know, 800 square meter or whatever it is, you know, plots, right, into five, right? So, it's, you know, it's 200, 300 squares, right? The value of that is a lot less, right? And yet, if you look at the market value of the individual villas, notice how they're called villas these days rather than townhouses, you know, it's trying to actually give us an impression of being rather grandiose. But that tells you something about what the true value of it actually is. So unfortunately, we've got the situation where people are making a lot of money on very poorly constructed, crammed in properties. And that's definitely what we're seeing on the low rise side as well as the high rise side. High rise, of course, is even worse. And by the way, just going back to those house price movements. Remember, we're talking about houses there, units nowhere near the same growth. They're still going backwards in a number of places. So that's funnily hardly ever reported. So everybody just picks up the top line house price movements and forgets the truth. And, you know, I always say go granular. Another point I wanted to make, though, I came out to Australia in 1995, right? I came from the UK. And over the previous 20 years in the UK, we'd had the privatization of many industries. We'd had the compression in terms of housing and all those things. We had so many of the, issues that I really didn't like much in the UK. Came out to Australia and it was like going back 20 or 30 years, right? So give you a very simple example. I was amazed the first weekend I was in Sydney when I actually took a ferry from Central Quay out to, I think it was probably Mossman, right? And there was a bus waiting at the wharf. They'd actually managed to sync up the bus with the ferry, right? And in fact, you could actually take that bus and it would sync up with another ferry at Manly, right? That idea of actually integrated transportation that actually worked, and the frequency was very good too, so it was pretty much every 30 minutes, right? That had gone 20 years ago in the UK, right? And now if you look at what's happened to transport in and around Sydney, it's gone exactly the same way. So we seem to be going down that same gurgler, where that sort of infrastructure that is a critical part of society and enabling people to get around and do what they want is just being degraded and degraded. And that's a minor example. You know, you could look at property, you could look at so many other examples too. But it seems like to me that we had an opportunity not just to ape what the Northern Hemisphere had done, but in fact we have aped it and we've actually ended up, you know, just following the same playbook and unfortunately ending in a rather similar position.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose in some ways, I think that's a little bit unfair to the Northern Hemisphere. I mean, there's parts of Austria, Germany, you know, places that, you know, that I've you know, stayed in for quite a period of time that are quite nice. The transport's quite good. The housing's, you know, the high rise housing is quite good. It's made with green spaces in mind. You know, there's even gardens for people. You know, and all these different things and. No, we don't have that here in Australia. Everything's about, you know, bottom dollar, bottom dollar, bottom dollar. And I don't know. I mean, I think one of the key things here in Australia is that we arrived at a population of 25 million decades before we were supposed to. You know, and honestly, I'm without getting off on too much of a tangent and an angry rant, as I'm probably known for at this point. It gets me when people say, "Oh, look at Victoria; their economy's crap." You know, they've fallen down per capita. They've done this and they've done that. And it's like, well, that's because you've jammed in all the people to Victoria. What did you think would happen? You know, it's just silly. You know, the federal government makes the decisions to pull the immigration lever in Canberra, and then it's the states who have to pick up the pieces and build the infrastructure and create the conditions for these people in which to live. And unsurprisingly, when you just throw more and more people at the economy to support headline GDP, it doesn't work out that well for people more broadly. And that's one of the reasons why per capita household disposable income has gone nowhere in the 10 years prior to the pandemic.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, the migration story and the immigration story is a critical part of the of the puddle. But of course, remember that migration at the moment is zero, right? I mean, we have a few people coming back from overseas, but you know, compared with previously, the growth of population is very much now down to homegrown. And yet we've still got house prices going through the roof, right? But if you look carefully at the effect of that migration over the last 10, 15, 20 years, you know, it's jammed into, as you say, some particular areas. The quality of life has been significantly degraded as a result. We've got lots and lots of high-rise development going on. Not sure who's going to live in those, but that's another story, I guess. And it's like, it's a playbook that is very, very simplistic, right? Which is more people means we can drive the GDP higher. Never mind where we're going to put them. Never mind the quality of life they're going to have. Never mind the ability for our infrastructure to support them. No one seems to worry about that. And that's a problem, I think, of the divided responsibilities between the feds and the states. And everybody can sort of say it's my problem, right? Which means that basically a lot of the issues that should be thought through aren't being thought through. And then, of course, the debate then turns on, well, no, it's just a planning issue, right? If we got the planning right, then, you know, we could have actually built more properties, etc. It's a much more fundamental issue than that, in my view. And I think, unfortunately, people then look for simplistic answers once again. And not surprisingly, it doesn't end well.
No, it doesn't. And that's something that I actually wanted to talk to you about regarding the sort of the way home prices and demand for housing has remained so strong despite the pandemic, despite the lack of immigration and international students and all that sort of thing. We've seen, like, you know, one of my Twitter followers quite rightly called primal demand for housing, and just wanting to get out and buy and, you know, have your own space and all that sort of stuff. And I think that that's a very, very large driver of the current demand for housing, especially from first home buyers, because, you know, you've been stuck in lockdown with mum and dad, you just want to get out, or you've been stuck with a roommate or whatever, and you just want your own space. You know, you just want something that's yours, that a landlord's not going to sell out from underneath you. And, you know, it's a very understandable, you know, sort of drive. And I was just sort of wondering, you know, do you have any sort of feel for how long that may sort of remain a significant factor driving the market?
Well, it's quite interesting. Again, we survey households and we ask about motivations for why they're, you know, wanting to buy. And security is definitely one of those that's high on the list. Another one which is there as well is the idea of capital appreciation, because people believe that once you're on the property ladder, then you're made for life in terms of you know, the value it's going to be created. That's some debatable. You know, it depends on all sorts of other things too. And it's interesting, one of the other factors that comes through in the surveys is that people seem to be more willing to team up with other people. So, you know, two or three or four friends might get together and buy a property together, right? Those sorts of things are happening. That's another lever that we're seeing at the moment. But a lot of it is, as you say, wanting freedom and wanting to own something. But I have to say, a lot of it is tinged with this investment lens as well. So the financialization of property, in other words, property is not just somewhere to live. It's not a cave, right, where you basically have a fire and, you know, you have a family, right? It's a way of making more money, right? That investment thread is so, so strong that even amongst first-time buyers, it's probably one of the most significant levers as to why people want to get into the market. So they want to do precisely what the previous generations have done and, you know, claim the prize of capital appreciation. But just remember, that's an anomaly. What's happened over the last 20 to 30 years is not what normally happens to property over the long term. And, you know, I think it's because of the financialization led from the deregulation of the finance system, from low interest rates, from weaker lending standards and all those things. All that's come in. And we've got this now mantra about accumulation, wealth creation, and property being associated with. And then, of course, you can say as stocks, as shares, as crypto. So there is something about the current psychology about doing things to create wealth for the future. I sometimes wonder whether that's a good thing or not.
No, well, it probably isn't. But you got me thinking, you know, what do you think a cave would run for in Sydney these days? I mean, I reckon you could get in there with some, you know, with some steel and some plasterboard. You could make it real nice. You know, it'd be like a Cooper Petey.
I reckon a Cooper. Yeah, and have a, you know, a bit of a drip of water in the back corner could be a water feature.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, you cut a hole in it with some harbour views, you got yourself a Flintstones house. I reckon you get a couple of $1 million for that.
Oh, exactly right. Anyway, around the harbour. Exactly right. And, of course, it's all sandstone, so you can just, you know, make a bit of a hole and off you go.
Yeah, I'm going to negatively gear my cave.
Exactly right. And, of course, the banks would love it and would be able to give you a lovely mortgage, providing you go on paying for the rest of your life.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll have to talk to the local council. I mean, I'm sure as long as they get the council rates, they might be keen.
Well, and of course, they'll probably charge you a penalty, you know, a fee and what have you. And of course, the one of the reasons why the development is where it is because every time there's a development, councils win.
Well, don't they ever? And okay, well, I'm just gonna make the comment without any sort of singling anyone out who I'm aware of who know who they are, and I'm just going to say that isn't it always interesting the way that property developers often end up as local councillors or mayors, and then all of a sudden their land gets rezoned to be worth millions.
Funny that, isn't it? And isn't it funny how scandals relating to land ownership and planning and things like that, you know, areas around the airport, for example, you know, the third airport. Funny that.
I'm positively shocked. I mean, you know, Australian politics is completely free of corruption.
Yes, indeed. We would never say anything other than that here on this channel, would we, Tarek? Would we? Now, you got some slides. Do you want to?
Oh, yeah, I will. All right, well, this is for the US manufacturing PMI, and it shows that the backlog of orders is continuing to rise to, well, amazing new heights, just as at the time that inventories are, well, basically collapsing to news. And obviously, this is one of the big current drivers that we're seeing of inflation in the US, which is, well, feeding into everything around the world. But I think it also speaks to the rather, I hate to use the same word as the Fed, but transitory nature of things. Because, you know, it's all well and good to say, oh, inflation, but the demand needs to be sustained for inflation to continue. And if this is what it's taking to get inflation to this level, it does make you wonder how they're going to be able to sustain inflation above 2 to 3% under the current circumstances. And if you want to chime in, Martin, obviously feel free.
Yeah, well, I just want to say that I recorded a show with Damien Klassen from Nucleus Wealth this morning, which will go up over the next couple of days, which we've called a masterclass on inflation, because he's gone through this in the same degree of detail. And his conclusion is it's pretty much transitory. There's no real structural inflation anywhere on the horizon.
Yeah, that's been my conclusion for a while now. I think that there is some, I mean, I suppose you could call it structural inflation in global food prices and the food supply. And part of that's the devaluation of the US dollar. But I think it's also just environmental issues, droughts, political issues, and a whole bunch of different other things all combining together to create this problem. But I'll move on to the next one. This is the ISM manufacturing report for prices, which has actually shown signs of peaking. And if you look very carefully, you'll see that in 2008, something very similar happened as the cycle ended. It peaked at a very, very similar point. And if we do see it roll over here, we could see, well, we could already have seen the peak of manufacturing, that there are a lot of commonalities between just prior to the financial crisis in 2008 and now, that we are seeing this inflationary burst, we are seeing rising commodity prices, and also the strong activity in the manufacturing sector. But by the same token, it's arguably something that is coming off the boil. And as you'll notice here, you're actually seeing the ISM Manufacturing Business Employment Index has actually already rolled over back to basically being roughly flat. Now, that doesn't speak to a high level of confidence among manufacturers of expanding their workforce, even though everyone's saying, oh, but look at the orders. And it's just not happening. And we saw something similar, which I'll get to in a couple of slides, in the services PMI. it's a similar story with the economic surprise index from Citi. You're seeing, you know, the manufacturing indexes and stuff, you know, quite high, roaring on ahead. But since pretty much the middle of last year, all of a sudden we started to see things, the number of positive economic surprises decline as all of these different, well, the recovery reflation narrative gets priced in, and we've, and it just continues to roll over and go lower and surprise to the downside. This is the ISM services PMI. So this is, you know, sort of things like pubs, clubs, hotels, tourism venues, those sorts of things. And obviously, as the US economy reopens, it's roared, it's gone to the moon. But like this, the manufacturing PMI, they've already sort of pared back on the growth in the number of new employees, which is, you know, quite a concerning sign. And this is actually something that that sort of put the fear in the market last night, as it, you know, it sort of dawned that, you know, maybe they weren't going to get the employment numbers that they thought. And this is another chart that shows the economic surprises. As you can see, it peaked, you know, the positive surprises peaked around about June last year, but inflation is continuing to surprise to the upside, because I don't know, the analysts don't really seem to get inflation for some reason. They just keep thinking that it's going to be weaker than they expect, but I think it's going to continue to be stronger than they expect until all of a sudden it's a lot weaker than they think it will be once these supply chain issues and all those sorts of things are finally resolved, whenever that may be. And this is an interesting one. It shows the recovery in US employment, that the low-income earner recovery actually peaked around about October, November last year, and has actually been declining despite the whole everything's going to be fine, everything's recovering. And yeah, things are going pretty great if you're a high-income earner. Things are going pretty okay if you're a middle-income earner. But if you're a low-income earner, things are pretty poor out there. And they aren't really showing signs of a swift recovery for this particular demographic, which is going to weigh pretty heavily on the US consumer economy going forward. You can't run an entire consumer economy solely on high income earners and middle income earners.
It's interesting, just on that, the data that I've seen from my surveys has the same sort of story here as well, that in fact, if you go back to that mortgage stress story that I keep coming back to, right? So a lot of high-income earners and middle-income earners are doing quite well, but it is the low-income earners that are really right in the crosshairs of mortgage stress now. And mortgage stress is still going up, and rental stress is going up even more strongly. So again, we have this two-speed affair where effectively part of the economy is doing okay, but a big chunk of it is just not.
Well, exactly. And that was something that sort of irked me a little when there was all the coverage of the recent GDP figures for Q1, and they're all like, oh, well, the economy's back to where it was. And it's like, well, on paper, in headline terms, yes, but more broadly, no, it's not, because, you know, people haven't got all their jobs back. People haven't got their businesses back. It's not that simple. And you know, it's like you say, you've got to go granular. You've got to look into things more deeply. I mean, you know, the US employment recovery looks fantastic. But when you look at it in these terms, it's like, wow, you know, people who are low income earners are getting absolutely smashed. And, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but from a political perspective, these are the people who are going to be the problem going forward. You know, these are the people who are going to turn out in droves to vote for the next populist candidate in 2024, whether that's Donald Trump or somebody else.
And of course, think of the numbers, the relative numbers, right? So, you know, the relative proportion in each of those categories is quite interesting, right? Because there's a relatively small proportion have very, very high incomes, quite a lot in the middle income bracket, and a massive proportion in the low income bracket.
Yeah, exactly. All right. This one I thought was particularly interesting, because it echoes some of the results of Westpac's own time to buy a dwelling index, although Westpac's index hasn't been impacted nearly as much. Buying conditions for US housing as perceived by US consumers has dropped to the lowest level since January 1983. And that is huge. I mean, even during the financial crisis, when heaps of people lost their jobs, you know, even in the 1990s, when interest rates went through the roof, nothing has damaged sentiment towards buying a house in the US as much as the current skyrocketing housing prices. And I think it's also important to keep in mind that last time buyer sentiment was this low, the conditions to buy a home in the US was this low, interest rates, bank interest rates were over 13%.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. Yep.
Here it is. The time to buy dwelling index, as you can see, it's well below the average with 119. It's actually down to 103, which is a fairly significant drop once you look back through all the data. And I think it speaks to future problems that we're going to see as first home buyers and other people who have, you know, perhaps a little bit less means to get into the market end up being priced out, and they just go, nah. You know, housing price expectations have gone to the moon, but people are saying, no, I'm just not going to play that particular game.
Mm. And that echoes to some extent the surveys that we see here, right? That in fact, more people now are thinking twice about taking a dip into the market simply because of the conditions.
Yeah, exactly. And that's it for today. If this is something that the audience enjoys, just, you know, leave a comment. Or if it's something that you don't enjoy, leave a comment. Just so I know if you're enjoying it or if I'm just giving you the shits.
Yeah, you know, it's good. What's interesting is that the feedback was quite interesting last time, right? There were a few people who said, "Oh, we just like the free form," but a lot of people actually did value the extra insight from the data. And you know, the DFA is a bit of a data driven channel, so I reckon we've probably got more against than not against. So, sorry, more for rather than against, I should say. Put it in the right order. So I appreciate that, and I think, you know, we're at an interesting bifurcation point, right? Because there are, on one hand, some signals of, you know, success and growth, et cetera, et cetera. But there are also now, I think, some lurking signals of questions that we should be asking. And I think over the next 2 or 3 weeks and maybe a month or two, we're going to start seeing some of those come to the surface. I think the next employment numbers from the US will be quite interesting. I think that some of the data here in Australia now, as the stimulus is being removed further, it'll take time to work through, but I'm seeing it in some of my data. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. And of course, we've still got the lurking virus in the background. So it ain't over yet.
No, it's going to be a very interesting couple of months. You know, there's going to be the US summer. There's going to be what will almost certainly be the peak of US inflation to come. You know, there's people like, you know, Nordea who are seeing, you know, in US inflation rising to 7 or even 8% year on year, which would just be, you know, absolutely huge. There's all these various different pieces of data that we're going to see in the next few months. And I think it's really going to get quite interesting. And I think it's also going to drive the Liberal Party and the government into holding an election this year, I would say, because that's my theory. I know there are quite a few people who disagree with me, and well, what's new? But you know, I think there is going to be a drive to go to the polls this year. I mean, all you got to do is look at the federal budget, and it's pretty clear that it's an election budget. They're not going to be waiting again until next year. They've already splashed all the cash that they're going to, and I think that, you know, it's all being very carefully massaged. And, you know, I think that, as I've said numerous occasions, you know, Scott Morrison is not someone to be underestimated. You know, like, don't get me wrong, I don't rate him much as a leader, but as a politician, he's incredibly cunning.
Yes, and there is an argument to say that you don't want to leave things too long because there's more opportunity for things to go wrong, right? You know, if you get another major breakout or, you know, something else, or, you know, people start getting, you know, adverse reactions to vaccines. Well, I mean, there are so many things that could happen. So in a way, if you've got the glimpse of, you know, the light on the hill, and you can see, you know, a story that you can spin to say, well, we've thrown all this money in and everything's going fine, we need another, you know, few years of coming back in to take it forward. And then, of course, what will happen is after the election, they will then turn around and say, oh, all that stimulus, we've got to actually now pay for it, and we've got to actually tighten the screws again. So, you know, this was definitely an election budget. And, you know, I think people should be thinking quite carefully about what happens after the election, and how much of the spending, which of course is being thrown into so many different corners without any real strategy in my view, is likely to be there in the long term, and how much of it's going to be withdrawn subsequent. So it's worth thinking about.
It is. And I think, as you were saying, just about the data more broadly, I think it's always just important to keep in mind exactly how much these numbers cost. You know, in the US, they got there, what was it, 1.56% Q1 GDP growth, and that cost them $2.8 trillion.
Bagatelle, you know, because effectively we're just devaluing money all the time, right?
Yeah.
Just add an extra naught on the end and nobody will notice.
Well, it's the same thing here in Australia. It's like, oh, we got 1.8% GDP growth. Well, how much did it cost? Well, the share of the deficit for 2020-2021, which was, yeah, I mean, what, well over $200 billion. So, you know, all it cost was a couple of hundred billion. What's a couple of hundred billion between mates?
Exactly. Just think what you could have done with that $200 billion if it was invested properly. But that's a whole other story. Tarek, I appreciate your time today. Always good to catch up with you on your slides, and we'll do it again soon.
Yeah, sounds good, mate. Looking forward to it.
Cheers. Thanks.
No worries, mate. Bye.